Wednesday, June 6, 2018. Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. It simply baffles me how so many can allow themselves to forget or simply choose to ignore all that we have discovered about past actions of the government and those in power and their abuses therein, and all that continues to be revealed with time, and all that's been acknowledged and proven, such as the knowing and willful fabrication of WMDs in Iraq, yet still seemingly make the conscious choice to once again trust them at their word today, even while many of the very same people involved in that egregious lie that was responsible for taking the lives of thousands of Americans and over 500,000 Iraqis are currently part of the Trump administration. And regardless of whatever those taking them at their word may tell themselves that makes them feel it's somehow different now versus then, should it not at least be considered that we may be once again being misled? Of course it should. And a healthy skepticism and constant questioning of the actions of those in power is quite literally the foundation on which this country was built. So the four stories I want to touch on today all demonstrate why it's so important to never unquestioningly accept the actions of our leaders, and that really give us an insight into past and present and possibly future actions of those in power and their seeming inability to ever be held accountable for their absolute tragic results and obvious impending repercussions and consequences. The first story coming from the Chris Ken YouTube channel entitled Kate Spade Found Dead, Clinton Foundation Worked with Designer in Haiti. And this is a very interesting story. And if you haven't checked out Chris Simpson's YouTube channel, Chris Ken, I highly recommend you do. He has does a great job of really presenting the information in a very unbiased and impartial way. Now, I felt compelled to cover this story simply because of all the many suspicious deaths relating back to the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation, many of which I've written about and covered in the past, in particular in relation to Haiti. Now, this is about Kate Spade, who was the sister-in-law to actor David Spade. She reportedly was found dead, and this deemed a suicide. Basically, apparently, she hung herself with a scarf from a doorknob, which at first glance does seem kind of odd. It definitely is possible, but seemed a little suspicious in general because you could simply stand up, but it's definitely possible to kill yourself like that. And apparently she did leave a note as well. Now, she was the former chair of the New York Center for Children. She had partnered with the Clintons in two different projects, one with the Clinton Foundation in Haiti, where she was, quote, part of a delegation from West Elm on an artisan fashion and manufacturing trip to the Port-au-Prince area to introduce them to potential investment and sourcing opportunities and to develop new partnerships with Haitian business owners. As a result, four new partnerships were formed between international retailers and several Haitian artisan businesses they met during the visit. Now, this is straight from the Clinton Foundation website, which is just very interesting. Now, first, before I get any further, the reason... it's possible that there's no connection here. Just because someone dies that once knew the Clintons, it's not always the right thing to just assume that there's some connection there. But the reason that this is important to at least consider is because of all of the many ones in the past that, as far as I'm concerned, are verifiable. And I'll get into a couple examples in a minute. But this one specifically, when we talked about the idea of the trafficking aspect, especially from Haiti, when it's known that Port-au-Prince is a hotbed for sex trafficking. And the fact that we've talked about in the past of the different connections of art dealers and their relation to being able to transfer shipping crates without being inspected from immigration and customs, and just that weird connection there to some of these groups in the past. But now we're seeing where she was involved in essentially setting up businesses overseas, especially in Port-au-Prince in Haiti. And knowing, Chris actually goes over one example of a story in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince specifically. There was a group that was a travel agency, and it was exposed as a fake company, essentially a front for a trafficking operation. So it seems interesting and worthy of suspicion that she was traveling to Haiti with the Clinton Foundation and setting up new businesses in Port-au-Prince, which is a hotbed for human trafficking. Now, again, this is all speculation, but based on the stuff we know from the past, and which, I'll get into in a second, it seems very likely that there's some kind of a weird connection here. And it just seems odd that so many people just happen to turn up dead that are connected with the Clintons, and more specifically, that were connected with the Clintons in Haiti. Now, she also partnered with the Clinton Foundation on it's called the No Ceilings Initiative project called Not There, which was an unprecedented collaboration to raise awareness and inspire action for gender equality, so says the site. So these are the two different times she's working with the Clintons. And now all of a sudden she shows up dead. And you know, really, there's no more to the story than that. And so that's something that I don't want to lead anybody to believe that there's some reason to think that there's an absolute, you know, a murder took place here. But it's a story that's worthy of our investigation. And I think it's good, worthy of pointing out. Now, two examples of ones in the past that were also deemed suicide that are very, very clear there was some foul play involved. One specifically that I wrote about was a doctor who was working with the Clintons in Haiti, who was in fact trying to expose the corruption there, which makes me wonder if maybe she stumbled across something with these businesses she was setting up that caused her to be a threat. Very possible, always worth considering. Now, this story was Dr. Dean Lorick, who was a prominent Manhattan surgeon who was found dead in his bathroom floor of his apartment by his 11-year-old daughter in December of 2017 with a knife to the chest. And that was deemed a suicide, which seemed very suspicious to me. He was known for his desire to expose the staggering inadequacies of the medical trauma care that was promised to the Haitian people by the Clinton Foundation after it raised $30 million in donations following the earthquake in 2010. While in Haiti, he discovered not only that the medical treatment promised by the Clinton Foundation was nowhere near $30 million worth, but that it was almost non-existent. He tried to raise the alarm by sending emails to people he thought would do something about it. And unfortunately, it ended up being forwarded to Cheryl Mills, who just happened to be the chief of staff to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at the time. Now, all of this was exposed by WikiLeaks and basically documents very clearly on record his disgust for the Clintons and their claims of fraud. And so it's important to take all that into account and the weird way he died and all of this and the fact that he was seeking to expose what the Clintons had done there. So I always find it interesting to wonder how somebody could have been involved in what they were doing in Haiti and not at least get word that there was something suspicious going on there. And I always bring up the case of Laura Silsby, who got caught on record trying to traffic Haitian children, and the Clintons got them off. So all this connection to Port-au-Prince and the trafficking, it's things worthy of investigation. The next case that I think is important to bring up in this story is that of Klaus Eberwein. I never know if I'm saying his name correctly. It's either Eberwein or Eberwin. Was a former Haitian government official and was found dead just a week before he was due to appear before the Haitian Senate Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission, where he was widely expected to testify that the Clinton Foundation misappropriated Haitian earthquake donations from international donors. According to the medical examiner records, the official cause of death was gunshot to the head, and his death was registered as a suicide by the government. But not long before this all happened, he was acknowledged by his friends and his family that he was claiming his life was in danger because he was an outspoken critic of the criminal activities of the Clinton Foundation. Which is just, how can we disregard something like that? Yet it was never really investigated. He was deemed a suicide and everybody moved on. According to him, a paltry 0.6% of donations granted by international donors to the Clinton Foundation with the express purpose of directly assisting Haitian people actually ended up in the hands of Haitian organizations. A further 9.6% ended up in the hands of the Haitian government, and the remaining almost 90% or $5.4 billion was funneled into non-Haitian organizations. So taking in all this information, this kind of a story stands out to me. I ask myself, well, you know, what did this woman possibly know? And could that have been the result of why she was killed, if that's the case? Again, just to make it clear, it's entirely possible this was just a random suicide. But I felt I wouldn't be doing my job if I did not bring this to your attention and say, this seems suspicious to me. Moving on to the next story from the freethoughtproject.com, California to fine citizens using over 55 gallons of water as Nestle pumps billions of gallons for free. California has become the first state to pass a law severely limiting the amount of water residents can use on a daily basis. And while politicians claim that the restrictions will be enforced in the name of conserving water, Nestle is illegally stealing millions of gallons of water each year, and the state is doing nothing to stop it. Now, we've talked about this many times in the past for many different states. Even the fact that the CEO of Nestle himself is on record saying that water is not a human right, which is increasingly alarming as water falls under the control of corporations such as Nestle and private groups. This whole idea seems kind of counterintuitive to me, the idea that any authority figure can tell us how much and how often we can use a natural resource, which does in a way kind of show you that they think that this is something they own, which is very interesting. Now, I do understand the concept of conservation, but something about this just seems wrong to me. Governor Jerry Brown signed Senate Bill 606 and Assembly Bill 1668 into law, both of which set new standards for water management planning. The restrictions will fully take effect by 2022, limiting residents to 55 gallons of water per person per day. That number will decrease to 50 gallons per person per day by 2030. Now, I found it very interesting that this is planning out to 2030, despite how much could possibly change by that point, and understanding how hard and almost next to impossible it is to get anything to change in this ridiculous system of ours. So regardless of what happens, we're pretty much stuck with this until 2030, which just kind of seems interesting, but I think very revealing in a lot of ways. Now, to put this into perspective, we're talking about 55 gallons of water per person per day. An 8-minute shower uses about 17 gallons of water. A load of laundry, about 40 gallons of water. And a bathtub can hold 80 to 100 gallons of water, meaning that residents would have to give up showers on days they wanted to do loads of laundry. And taking a bath would be basically impossible. And each time an individual flushes a toilet, up to 7 gallons of water is used. And around 6 gallons of water is needed for a full dishwasher cycle. If a family fails to budget how much water is being used by each child during the course of a day, or their home has a water leak they're unaware of, they could end up facing massive fines. But I mean, think about the idea of that. Simply flushing the toilet uses 7 gallons of water. How many times do people go to the bathroom a day? I mean, just this seems completely nonsensical to me. I truly think this is part of the design. The author asked the very appropriate question, is California conserving water in all aspects, or are residents being forced to cut back while corporations have free rein and the government fails to intervene? I think that's a pretty obvious question. In December 2017, the Free Thought Project reported that Nestle has been illegally extracting more than 60 million gallons of water per year from California's San Bernardino National Forest, which amounts to billions of gallons of water stolen over the last 68 years, even though it lacks the legal rights and has never provided a valid basis of right to the water. This is while California has been going through a drought over the last so many years. So Californians should be absolutely livid when they realize that it's being mandated, written into law, that they have to conserve their water or they're going to be fined, while Nestle steals millions of gallons of water without any legal right and the government simply looks the other way. I mean, how many examples like this do we need before we begin to realize that there's a reason these things happen? There's a reason these corporations are never actually held accountable, whether it's money or simple connections, talking about revolving door politics, people working on their board that once worked for politics and vice versa. It's very clear that this is happening in more than just water, but in every possible aspect of our government. And that is something that has to be alarming to all of us and has to show us the real nature of our government today. Moving on to the next story coming from theantimedia.com, it's time to admit that U.S.-led forces committed war crimes in Raqqa, Syria. Last year's Washington-led coalition effort against the Islamic State group in the Syrian city of Raqqa included numerous, quote, disproportionate or indiscriminate attacks on the city, showing little regard for civilian lives and constituting potential war crimes, a new report by Amnesty International stated on Tuesday, which for many watching this channel is likely not very surprising, but it's very hopeful to see that people like Amnesty International and many others, by the way, are beginning to point this out. And as the title goes states, it's time to admit something that many of us have been pointing out for a very long time. And it's something that we need to continue to show the world does not represent the actual will of the people. The campaign to seize Raqqa spanned June to October of last year and entailed tens of thousands of U.S. and allied air and artillery strikes in support of the Syrian Democratic Forces, a U.S.-backed force dominated by Kurdish YPG militia, which are basically Western-backed terrorists, even by the admission of a NATO member of Turkey who claims YPG is a clear terrorist organization. The report quotes U.S. Army Sergeant Major John Wayne Troxell, who said, quote, in 5 months, the U.S. Marines fired 30,000 artillery rounds on ISIS targets. They fired more rounds in 5 months in Raqqa, Syria, than any other Marine or Army battalion since the Vietnam War. Every minute of every hour, we were putting some kind of fire on ISIS in Raqqa, whether it was mortars, artillery, rockets, hellfires, armed drones, you name it. According to Amnesty International, artillery shells have a margin of error over 100 meters. So it's no surprise that the result was mass civilian casualties. Around 90% of airstrikes and bombardments and the entirety of artillery strikes were carried out by U.S. military personnel, while the remaining airstrikes were launched by British and French forces. As Mint Press News has reported, coalition forces also widely deployed white phosphorus, a banned chemical weapon, in spite of its urgings that the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad refrain from the use of chemical agents in the war. Rather than being liberated by coalition forces, the people of Raqqa instead faced a war of annihilation that claimed thousands of lives while displacing tens of thousands of residents from their homes. And this is something we have to begin to acknowledge, not just in Raqqa, but any of the many different war zones created by the U.S., or rather those disingenuously pretending to present the will of the United States across the world, and how all of it ends up in the decimation of the countries they claim to be liberating. And it's something it's always carried out under the guise of humanitarianism, which is just so disgustingly disingenuous when you see that the very people they're claiming to protect are the ones who are being murdered. And we have to understand that they were fully aware that there were civilians in these areas. And yet his description of bombing relentlessly, they had to know that there were people that were dying there. And they just consider that collateral damage, which has to show you the real mentality involved in all of this. And then you have to add in the concept of understanding that ISIS in general has been proven to be simply a U.S. proxy. So what does all this mean? Were they willing to kill these civilians simply to pretend to have a war with ISIS so they could take over Syria as a way to weaken Bashar al-Assad, which has been the verifiable plan for decades? More than likely. And it's something we have to begin to recognize is going on in many more places than just Syria, all across the world, in the name of every American. Moving on to the next story and the final story of the day, coming from MiddleEastMonitor.com, Israeli minister calls for preemptive killings of Palestinians who launch kites. An Israeli minister said yesterday that Palestinians who launch kites from Gaza should be assassinated. Israel's public security minister made the comments while speaking at an event in a city close to the border with Gaza. The minister told his audience that, quote, kite terror is very serious, and whoever sends them should fear for their life, clearly showing yet again, despite claims of defense, these are acts of retaliation and punishment, which falls squarely under the category of a war crime or human rights violation, especially when you consider that these may simply be kites, as are shown to be used regularly with no ill intent. It's a similar concept of somebody throwing a rock and then being shot in the head. Even if they are trying to do something by throwing that rock, shooting them in the head is not proportionate in any way, shape, or form, and is very clearly a war crime or human rights violation. The minister added that, quote, we need to return to the preventative assassinations. Those who send the kites, and seemingly just states also Hamas commanders, must be a target for preventative killings. Israel has accused kites flying from Gaza during the recent Great March of Return of sparking wildfires in southern Israel, although there has been no proof that these have actually been the cause. And even if being used as some means of starting fires, the absolute disparity in means here between the two sides have to make this stand out is absolutely appalling. That they're openly calling for the assassination of anyone simply flying a kite, and despite making the claim that it could possibly start a fire. Even if that's the case, we have to stand back and see how ridiculous these claims are and how openly they're making these claims, knowing that they're not going to be held accountable. But with all of this today, whether we're talking about the ability of the elite to kill, lie, cheat, and steal with impunity, or the willingness of our politicians to ignore the illegal and detrimental actions of the major corporations that just so happen to line their pockets, the intrinsically destructive nature of U.S. foreign policy, despite its incessant claims to the contrary, or the way our ruling oligarchy blatantly disregards the disgustingly obvious human rights violations of its allies, while manufacturing lies about crimes far less severe committed by its enemies in order to wage illegal wars in the name of liberation, yet killing the very people they feign to be fighting to protect. The same question comes to my mind day after day. How can this still be allowed, accepted, justified? With all that we know, with all that's been admitted, how can so many turn a blind eye to such depravity, such pure malicious hatred and profiteering? They do so out of fear or convenience, while others still do so out of blind subservience to that which they have convinced themselves is the best there is in a world falsely perceived to be overflowing with external threats. While I simply will not believe that that is most people, I refuse to accept that the majority sees such obvious crime, deception, corruption, and human suffering and feels good about it. So as I have many times in the past, I end today by asking all of you out there who agree that change is possible, that there is a better way, to take action in your daily life, even in small ways that only affect your immediate surroundings, to share this message, to fight for the goodness that is out there, and gently plant this seed of reality in the minds of those who look away when confronted by the truth. Because as long as we keep fighting, keep standing when others remain seated, refuse to be cowed by fear of the unknown, change will always be possible. For more information on the topics discussed, make sure you check out thelastamericanvagabond.com or any of the important independent sources in the show notes below. And as always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.